Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents River of Shadows by Karina Halley. Narrated by Joe Raylan. The Arrival. We come from the land of the ice and snow where the midnight sun and the hot springs flow. Robert Plant sings through my noise-canceling headphones as the plane begins its descent. My music choice was certainly apt, since there's nothing but ice and snow for miles. I don't even see the town of Ivalo, let alone the airport where we're supposed to be landing shortly. There's just low rolling hills of white until they blend in with the monotone sky like we're flying into nothingness. A flutter of panic forms in my chest, and I immediately grip my armrest, my eyes pinching shut. I'm lucky no one's seated next to me on this Finnair flight from Helsinki up to Lapland, because I've been riding the Hot Mess Express the whole time. One minute, tears are streaming down my face, lost in grief and regret over my father. The next, I'm having a full-on panic attack, wondering what the hell I'm doing, flying to not only Finland, but the remote north of the country all by myself. I'm no stranger to taking flights alone. It's a part of my job, but this time it's different. My mother refused to come to my father's funeral. And I'm an only child, which means I have to carry the burden without any support. I've never even been to a funeral before. At least I've been to Finland, though this is my first time in Lapland. I was actually born in the town of Savonlinna, but my mother left my father when I was only 6 years old, ushering me off to California. I don't remember much of my childhood in Finland, and my only other visits were every other summer, one growing up. My father fought long and hard to see me when he could, and I later learned that it was only when he threatened my mother with a custody battle that she relented and let me visit. Suddenly a memory floods my mind, making my heart feel waterlogged. I had been staying with my father at his lakeside cottage where he lived, having just come in from a refreshing near-midnight swim. Despite the hour, the sun was still shining, as it does in the summer months, and the air was thick with dragonflies that buzzed about on kaleidoscope wings, nipping at the mosquitoes. I walked along the dock, a towel draped around me, wet footprints in my wake, wondering where my father had gone, when suddenly he appeared in the doorway to the cottage. Only he was pretending to be someone else. Santa Claus. My father was one of those people, like Leslie Nielsen or Christopher Lloyd, who always looked old, with his prematurely white hair and beard, so he suited the role perfectly. He stood there in the waning golden light of the summer sun, dressed in the red velvet Santa suit, a sack full of toys beside him. I was about 8 or 9 years old enough to not believe in Santa Claus anymore. And even if I had, it would have given me a major pause to have Santa come visit during the summer. But I know from the letters my father would write, my mother didn't let us talk on the phone very often, that he missed having me around at Christmas, especially since Finland is Santa's home, and so I played along happily, reveling in his attention and the toys and treats, of course. My chest grows warm at the memory, and yet there's a sharp pinch between my ribs. That's how it's been ever since I got the phone call that my father had died. Every moment I feel like I'm torn between two worlds. The world where my father is still alive and my life can carry on as usual. And the world where my father is dead and my life has changed irrevocably, never to be the same. It was my father's colleague, Nora, who had made the call a week ago. She told me that my father had gone for a walk in the woods and somehow became disoriented. A search party found him the next day, coated in ice and snow. Dead. The news didn't feel real at the time. To be honest, it still doesn't. It feels like those two worlds are still intermingling with each other, and I keep being bounced around, and I never know where I'll land. Sometimes I just wish that the grief would set like cement, because the moments where the reality crashes upon me can be too difficult to bear. I'd rather be stuck in the thick of it all the time, as real and raw as possible, as if I could get the pain over with. People assumed that because I rarely saw or spoke to my father that we didn't have a close relationship. But the strange thing is that despite the distance, I felt closer to him than my mother. It's like we had our own silent language, or some kind of magnetic tie between us that kept us connected throughout my life. I always felt him with me, felt his love, even when we were technically estranged. That's the part that hurts the most, though. After high school, when my mother moved to Seattle with her now husband, George, and I was still in L.A., I thought about going to Finland. I thought about asking if my father would come to L.A. I thought these things, but along with the thoughts of I should stop eating so many donuts and I don't need to watch Howl's Moving Castle again, and I certainly don't need another succulent for the patio, they never came to fruition. I just thought them and moved on, making the mistake of thinking there was plenty of time. I decided that a year from now, when I turned 25, that's when I'd finally take a vacation from work and go see my father. I thought that's when I'd start making him, my family, a priority. I never thought he'd die. Not now, frankly, not ever. He didn't seem the type, and if you'd met him, you'd know. My father was like an unstoppable force. He was the life of the party, popular to the bone, full of life and zest. People loved him, and he loved people. My father had this way of making you believe in magic, in that anything in the world was possible, and that you could be anything you wanted to be. And now, he's gone. There has to be a mistake, I think to myself as the plane slams down onto the runway. I grip the armrests tighter, warily glancing out the window at the snow that's blowing across the slice of bare pavement on the runway. We bump along for a while and finally come to a stop. I let out the breath I was holding as the flight attendant starts speaking in Finnish, so fast that I can't understand a word of it. I have a very rudimentary grasp of the language from what my father taught me as a child, and I'll admit it was only because Finnish inspired Tolkien's elvish language that made me stay interested in it. It doesn't take long for me to exit the plane, considering how small it is, and it was only half full to begin with, February being Lapland's off-season. I still have to wait for my carry-on bag, though, since they made me check it because of the diminutive overhead bins, and it's while I'm waiting at baggage claim in what must be the world's tiniest airport that I feel a burst of cold at my back. For a moment, I'm disoriented, dizzy, and the skin on my scalp prickles. I turn around to see a middle-aged woman staring at me, short with a graying blonde bob and round, weathered cheeks that shine like apples. She's smiling, though her dark eyes aren't. "Welcome to Sampi," the woman says to me in a thick accent, and though I've never met her before, I immediately know it's Nora. In fact, I can hear her name being sung in my head, as if from a robin on a branch, and I have to blink a few times to right myself. Jet lag is no joke. "Sampi?" I repeat. "Dear God, don't tell me I got on the wrong flight." "It's what we Sami people call Lapland," she says. Then she extends her hand like an afterthought. "I'm Nora, but you already knew that. I'm sorry we couldn't have met under better circumstances. You meant the world to your father. There wasn't a day where he didn't talk about his dear Hanna." "Don't cry. Don't cry." I shake her hand briefly and manage to hold myself together, only because I'm still a bit confused. "How did you know what flight I was on?" Nora gives a half-smile.
"You said you'd be here for the funeral tomorrow, and there's not many flights coming up here.
Lucky guess." She reaches out and tugs at my black wool coat.
"This might be fashionable, but this won't keep you warm."
I'm about to point out that she's dressed only in a thick wool sweater herself, but decide to keep my mouth shut.
"Your father told me that you work for a clothing company,"
she says, her attention still fixed on me. Those dark eyes of hers, sharp as tacks.
"Something to do with the internet."
"Social media," I tell her, raising my chin slightly. I'm 5'10", and Nora is a lot shorter than me, but whenever I have to explain my job, I feel like I'm suddenly very small. The minute someone hears that I'm in fashion, and then hears that I'm in social media, they tend to make an assumption about me pretty fast. "Social media manager," I add. "It's basically how we do all advertising and marketing these days." She nods and finally looks away to the baggage carousel, breaking eye contact. I feel a strange rush of relief, like I can breathe again.
I told your father we could use someone like you for the resort, but he always brushed me off, saying that the right people would find the place. He was right, in the end.
She lifts her arm and points as my rose-gold hardcover suitcase appears on the belt.
There it is.
This time I don't have to ask how she knew. Not many rose-gold suitcases up here. I stride over to the carousel and pick up my bag, taking a moment to gather my thoughts. I've always been someone who can pick up on vibes. My father used to call me an empath. My mother says I'm too damn sensitive. And Nora has vibes up the wazoo. But she did take the time to meet me here, and perhaps the strange energy I'm getting off her might be because she's grieving as much as I am. My father moved up north to open his resort 5 years ago, and though I'd never heard him mention Nora, it's possible they were really close. Maybe in ways I don't want to imagine. I remind myself to stop making judgments and assumptions and roll the bag over to her.
Good, she says with approval. I will drive you to the resort now.
Oh, I pause, gathering my coat collar. But the funeral isn't until tomorrow.
Yes, she says patiently. But you are staying at the resort.
It's not a request, it's an order. I shake my head. I booked and paid for a hotel room in town already. I won't get a refund if I cancel. She gives me a placating smile.
You will get a refund. I know all the hotels here. Don't worry about it.
She pauses, light brows furrowing.
I must say I was disappointed when I didn't see you book a room at the resort.
Then she turns and heads over to the doors to the outside, a marching-like walk.
I know, I admit after a moment following her. I guess because it didn't show up on the hotel booking site I use. Creature of habit.
That's not the total truth, though. I'd always wanted to stay at my father's wellness resort, even before it started getting some recognition amongst the travel influencers who stumbled upon it in their quest for something new. But the idea of finally staying there, only to have him gone, felt wrong to me in ways I can't really explain. Like, it was easier to just stay elsewhere and put a bit of distance in. As if that's going to make any of this hurt less. We walk through the automatic doors to the outside, and the air is a slap to the face, freezing my lungs. It's cold as hell, with snow covering every inch of land, including the sidewalks, and cars are making fresh tracks on the road. I'm cursing myself for not bringing a parka. I'm also wishing my luggage had skis attached to the wheels.
So your mother isn't coming,
Nora notes as we walk to the parking lot, and I drag the luggage through the snowdrifts. I shake my head, trying to ward off the anger that sparks inside me. Nora told me she had called my mother before she called me. As soon as I got the news about my father, I texted my best friend, Michelle, first, then told my roommate, Jenny. There was a lot of crying and drinking shots of bourbon in shock. I didn't actually call my mother until the next morning. I knew that Nora had told her, but Nora had never told my mother that she was calling me. Which meant my mother had no idea I knew my father was dead, and she sat on that fucking information for 24 hours. Maybe even more had I not called her. And fuck, even if I wasn't an empath, I could have picked up on her vibes loud and clear over the phone. She thought it was good that he was dead. So no, my mother isn't coming to the funeral. I'm sure it would be too hard for her, I say, but from my meek voice, I know that Nora won't believe me. I don't believe me either. It's all bullshit. But Nora just nods as we head toward a small red hatchback. Once inside the car, I met with a plethora of smells, a lot of them familiar, like sage and Palo Santo. The rest earthy, bitter, and cloying. Because my legs are long, they're crammed up against the glove box, and I have to wrestle with the seat control until it slams back. Nora looks over at me with amusement, and for once I see it reach her dark eyes.
Just like your father, she comments. He was tall, too. Is your mother the same?
I shake my head and scoff. She's 5'2", and a delicate little flower. And boy, she never lets me forget it either. Nora makes a low, noise and starts the car, fiddling with the heat. The controls were set low, which strikes me as odd, but maybe the cold isn't a problem for her. She's only wearing a sweater, after all.
We have no use for delicate people up here, she says stiffly. They don't survive very long. Sorry, I'll have the heat on in a moment.
The car backs up and then rolls across the parking lot, the tires on snow making a pleasing crunching sound.
Your father told me you used to be a dancer.
Yes, I say, the bitterness in the air now settling on my tongue. Unfortunately, you have to be a delicate flower in dance, and there was a point where I couldn't do that anymore. In other words, dance was everything to me, and especially to my mother. But the extremes I went to so I could remain lithe and airy and light eventually took their toll on my body and mind. But then I discovered martial arts. Capoeira, it's from Brazil, combines dancing and fighting. Nora takes her eyes off the road to look at me.
You never mentioned that.
I shrug. I'm not competitive. My heart can't take anything competitive anymore, not after what I went through. It's just a hobby. After high school, I realized if I couldn't be accepted in dance anymore, then I wanted to do something else to keep my body moving. I started building muscle, lifting weights, and it just came naturally to me. I used to do a little taekwondo for a while, even harness, but capoeira is what stuck. Nora's vibe shifts a little, like this information concerns her. Perhaps she's old-fashioned and doesn't believe girls should fight. She'd get along with my mother with that view. I flash her a placating smile. Don't worry, I'm not going to go beating up anyone at Papa's funeral. She gives me a stiff smile and I immediately feel awkward. I look around the car.
So, what's the smell? Do you like it?
She asks.
Not really.
Smells like sage.
And like rotting corpses.
I add in my head, and the accurate thought makes me shiver. I pull my coat closer around me, my cold hands shoved in my pockets. I've always been morbid, but I don't need these thoughts before my father's funeral.
Sage, palo santo, lavender, myrrh, and sienna. Mushrooms.
Didn't know dried mushrooms smell like that.
These ones are special.
Aren't all mushrooms special, I think. If I actually had a social life in high school, maybe I'd know what dried mushrooms smell like. I turn my attention to the scenery passing by the window. Like the view from the airplane, the land is made up of pine trees and snow, with a few low rolling hills thrown into the mix. I have a feeling we're driving past lakes and rivers, but the thick snow covers them and makes everything look the same. It's such the opposite of Los Angeles that I'm suddenly hit with a pang of fear. Like I'm on the edge of the earth, close to falling off into infinity, and I feel precariously placed. In my mind, I'm looking at the globe, and I can see the little dot where I am, and there's just nothing above me at all except ice and snow forever. Not only that, but I've barely seen any cars on this highway, and I realize I don't know Nora at all. I'm about to pull out my phone and check for reception, maybe send Jenny a text, even though I have no idea what time it is back home, when the skin on my spine starts to crawl. I have the most awful, unsettling feeling that if I look at Nora right now, that I won't see Nora at all. That I'll see some smiling, demonic creature. In fact, out of the corner of my eye, I swear I see a pair of horns, no, antlers, growing from the top of her head. I immediately close my eyes and take in a deep breath. Jet lag, I tell myself. Grief and jet lag. Hell of a combo.
Are you all right?
Nora asks. I nod, pressing my lips together, keeping my eyes closed. Just really tired all of a sudden.
Why don't you sleep? The resort is another 4 to 5 minutes away.
Hell no, I'm not sleeping now, I think, resting my head against the frozen window. But then the car engine suddenly turns off and I hear Nora say,
"We're here."
My eyes snap open and I sit upright in my seat. We're parked in front of a low, rustic building, the roof piled high with snow, a forest surrounding it, the branches glittering in the waning sun like icing sugar. What the hell? I blink and shake my head. What happened? I literally just closed my eyes.
You fell asleep, she says. Come on, let's get you to your room so you can go to bed.
My brain feels like a train that's slowly pulling out of the station as I try to make sense of how time has passed so quickly. You're not supposed to sleep the first day you arrive, not until night. Otherwise, you'll never get over your jet lag, I tell her, my tongue feeling thick.
It'll be night in an hour, she says in a no-nonsense voice.
She gets out of the car and opens up the trunk, pulling out my suitcase. I stare at the log building, at the intricately carved sign that says Wilderness Hotel over it, smoke rising from the chimney. I guess this is it. This is what my dad worked so hard for. Like clockwork, I feel hot tears behind my eyes, and I take in a sharp, shaking breath, trying to ward them off. I don't want to cry in front of Nora. I feel like I can't let myself be vulnerable in front of her. I get out of the car, the air even colder here, but bracingly fresh, peppered with the smell of pine and wood smoke. There are only four other cars in the parking lot. I guess it's not very busy right now, I observe, walking somewhat unsteadily over to Nora, holding my hand out for my suitcase.
Shoulder season, she says, keeping the suitcase away. We only have one guest at the moment. You relax. Eero will take care of your bag.
I'm about to ask who Eero is when the door to the hotel opens and a tall, robust man with a long gray beard appears in the frame. For a moment, I swear I'm staring at my dad. Except this man looks older and somehow crueler. I know that's an odd thing to glean from someone's looks, but it's all in his eyes. Once again, my vibrator is going off the rails. He walks over to us and gives me a wide smile, taking the suitcase from Nora. He's wearing a reindeer fur vest over a snowsuit and a white and red knitted cap that stands tall on his head, the ear flaps hanging by his cheeks. At least he seems more appropriately dressed.
Nice to meet you, Hannah,
he says in a deep voice.
I'm Eero. I was a good friend of your father's. We are so glad you are here.
I can only muster a half smile. I know I might seem rude and standoffish, but I just can't shake the weird feeling. He exchanges a look with Nora that I can't read, and they head toward the hotel.
As you know, the premise of the hotel is that guests can stay in little wilderness cabins in the woods and by the lake, all perfectly placed for watching the northern lights,
Nora says as we walk down the path to the hotel entrance.
But we figured it would be better if you stayed in one of the rooms in the main lodge here. That way you won't feel so alone. I imagine with your jet lag and your grief, all of this must feel quite confusing by now.
She glances at me over her shoulder.
Tomorrow morning I'll give you a tour. For now, you rest.
Suddenly, I'm too tired to protest. Eero opens the door and leads us into the hotel, the air smelling of butter, cinnamon, and cardamom, my stomach rumbling in response. The lobby is wonderfully rustic, with the log cabin walls, woven tapestries and paintings, numerous chandeliers made of reindeer and moose antlers hanging from the ceiling with flickering candles in them. I know that was 100% the aesthetic choice of my father. I look around and catch a glance of a dining room, lounge, and kitchen before they lead me upstairs to my room, located down a narrow hallway. Eero opens the door and places my bag beside the bed. I step inside, quickly taking it in. The room is simple, with birch walls and fur curtains, though it smells just like Nora's car.
We'll see you in the morning,
Nora says to me as they start to leave. Wait, I spin around and she pauses in the doorway. It's only 3 p.m. Where are you going?
You need your sleep,
Eero says, not answering my question at all. Then he closes the door. I stare at it for a moment, part of me almost expecting it to lock from the outside, but of course it doesn't. I walk over to the window and peer outside. I'm looking right onto the parking lot, which gives me a bit of comfort for some reason. Even though they seem hell-bent on me going to sleep right now, I'm grateful they put me in here instead of out in the forest. I already feel thoroughly creeped out, and for no reason at all. I decide to lie down on the bed to test it out. It's a queen, and quite firm, but my body immediately relaxes into it. I should unpack, and then maybe find Nora and see if I can get something to eat. Text Michelle and Jenny and my mom, and let them know I... But the thought starts to drift away. My eyes close. My eyes open. Darkness. Complete and total darkness. For a moment, I think I'm dead. Then I see a green light above me blink on and off, and I realize it's a smoke detector. I fumble for my phone, and it's in my pocket. I'm still wearing my damn coat. I bring it out and turn it on. The time is 10 p.m., the light bright, making me wince, and the photo I have of my father and me as the screen wallpaper makes me want to burst into tears. I manage to hold it together and shine the light around the room until I see the bedside lamp and switch it on. Well, I just totally passed the fuck out, didn't I? This is exactly why I wanted to stay awake as long as possible. Now I'm wide awake when everyone else is going to sleep. I sigh and get up. Use the washroom, splash some water on my face. Then my rumbling stomach tells me I need to get something to eat. Even though I'm sure Nora and Eero are asleep, and I have no idea if they live at the hotel or elsewhere, maybe I can help myself to something in the kitchen. I leave my room and walk down the stairs to the main level, heading toward the kitchen. I'm almost there when I notice another room, just past the dining room and lounge. While there are only a few lights on in the hotel and it's eerily quiet and empty, I can see flickering candles dancing on the walls. Hear the soft sound of music? The music itself is strange and becoming, like choir voices and low tribal drumming. I walk toward it, feeling the need to be quiet for some reason. Then stop. There's a casket in the room, lit by candles on either side, chairs lined up on either side of the room. Oh, my God. This is where the funeral is being held. I swallow hard as I walk into the room, my eyes drawn to the casket. Beside it is a blown-up picture of my father's face, some smiling moment out in the sun when he was younger. And that's when it hits me. I mean, it really hits me. Like I'm in the middle of train tracks, and for once, I don't see the locomotive coming. Tears spring to my eyes, and I'm frozen. Stunned by the immensity of it all, of the fact that life will keep going on without my dad in it. And how fucking unfair that is. I don't even notice that my knees are buckling and I'm collapsing into the ground. I don't even notice the strangled cry that's ripped from my throat, filling the empty room. I don't notice anything but the devastatingly cold and hard realization that my father is gone. He's gone. He's really gone. He's dead, and he's not coming back. But it can't be true. It just can't. Why do I still feel him within my heart? Why do I still feel that connection? Because you're delusional, a voice in my head says. But it just can't be true. People like my father, they just don't die. They're the type that live forever. They're the ones that defy the odds. They're larger than life, larger than death. My father can't be living on this planet one minute, drinking coffee and listening to birdsong, having the sun on his face, and then not. You can't just stop being. You can't stop what has started. How dare God take him like this to just decide my dad's time was enough? It's not enough. It's never enough. Papa, I cry out, my voice breaking and echoing in my ears. I sound like a child. I feel like a child. Oh, God, I would do anything to be a child again, to go back, to be with him. I want to be young again. I want to do this over again and get it right this time. I want to tell my mother that I'm not leaving him. That I'm staying with him. I want to go back, I whisper hoarsely, my face buried in my hands. I want to go back to when I was your little girl. I want another chance. I can't move on like this. Not in this world, not without you. But the room gives nothing. And there is the casket at the end. And my father's wonderful smiling face beside it, and all I feel is so much despair and sorrow and regret. A deeper cut than bone deep. A cut that will never, ever heal. A scar for all my life. Right in the heart of me. I stay on the floor of the room for what could be minutes. Might be hours. It's hard to tell when I'm jet-lagged. Eventually, though, I staggered to my feet, leaning on the chairs to push myself up. I know I should turn around.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?